yeah, I got your email or your voice message.
I would like to call to order the task force on class size for today, August 2nd. I want to thank all of you for being here today and really thank all of those who have been to all three meetings. I believe we have two people on the phone so far, Colin Robinson and Paula Nelson.
Ann Bryan is also on the call.
Hi, Ann. Thank you very much for calling in today.
Thanks for making this option available. I appreciate it.
You bet. At this time, for those of you that are joining us for the first time, my office and Nicole, who's sitting right back over here, is trying really hard to send out emails that gave you a little bit of a summary of what we've discussed at the last meeting. If you haven't had a chance to watch it, and I totally understand if that's not been available or something you have time to do. But we, in the first meeting, really did look through the different types of research that our staff had found and had been utilized a number of times on class size task forces. And we also had an opportunity to talk about the quality education model, something that we did get some agreement on a few years back, and we were trying to figure out how we connect some of these conversations about things like absenteeism and relationships with teachers and class sizes. And we know that they're an integrated body of work that needs to be looked at because they're all important. And we've been trying to check out the quality education model. And I know we have a brand new report that came out yesterday on August 1st. And I believe we've got copies of that. And if not, it's also been emailed.
It's actually on our website right now. So that's probably the best place to get it.
And I know that Jan McComb tried to give you page numbers of different parts of the report so that you didn't have to wade through all of it to find a specific area that you might personally be interested in. So we talked about the research, and we certainly will add new research. I believe we have someone today who would like to add a report. There may be some folks in the future that want to do some more testimony, and we're more than welcome to do that. If there is any more research, we'd try to like to bring that to the next meeting we can all agree to. And we want to get off the research and then start talking about basically how does it connect to the quality education model? How can we go forward with possible suggestions for a short report in September, since we weren't seated as a task force until the middle of July? And then I'm going to talk at the end of the meeting a little bit about some work I hope that some of you will be willing to continue with us after the September short report, because we can actually act as a task force through December. And so I want to make sure that we have an opportunity to take some of the good thoughts and ideas that we've been able to pull out and, you know, really continue with them if there are folks that want to do that. So we'll talk about that a little later. So first, I want to, on the agenda, go to the answers to outstanding questions. And we've been asking staff to help us with that. And Brian, I believe you brought some information to add to the pile.
Yes, I brought two things today. One, there was a request to compare Oregon class sizes to federal class sizes over time. The feds don't actually gather class size data. What they gather is student-teacher ratios, which are usually considerably lower than class sizes because not all teachers are in the classroom all the time. So what I have here is a history of student-teacher ratios. These are the state average for Oregon and then the national average. And what you see, really two things. Oregon is considerably above the national average and has been for this entire period. But the other thing that's interesting to me anyway is that Oregon's fluctuates more than the national average. And I think my first reaction to that is probably the reason is because our revenue system is more volatile than the national one, and those increases, the two bump ups you see, the first one in around 02, 03, 03, 04 period, that was a recession in Oregon. Revenue suffered, and therefore school funding suffered, and our student teacher ratio went up. And then again in the recession in the late 2000s, the same thing happened. I think if you went out a couple more years, you would see us start to come back down because funding was better in the 13-15 biennium and also the 15-17 biennium, so considerably more money in Oregon than prior to that. So I think our ratios probably will come down a little bit in those years. I did a little math here in my head. The difference back in 97-98 was 3.3 students, and the difference in 13-14 is 6.1 students. So a growing gap between Oregon and the national average.
Okay, thank you. And I believe the other... you guys, can you mute your phones maybe until you have something you want to share? Thank you. And the other one, I believe, was the blended class size.
The other one is, the question was, how many blended classrooms do we have? And so what I did is I looked in the data we have on class sizes and pulled out all of the blended class sizes, or all those classrooms in Oregon that have students from multiple grades. And I have them here. I want to call your attention, if you go to the next to the last page at the bottom, the Boone's Ferry Primary School in West Lynn. That looks like a data error to me. What it says is they've got 22 kindergartners and 27 first graders in the same classroom. That doesn't sound right to me. I found a couple of similar errors in the data, and I just didn't catch this one before I printed it. The department asks districts to distinguish between classrooms both by a classroom ID number and a teacher ID number. And the problem we have here is it looks like they use the same classroom ID number for what are really two different classrooms. So I think all the other data, though, are pretty clean. And what you see is most of them are classrooms with two different grades in them. But when you get into much smaller schools in small districts, you will see more than two grades. And so, I mean, a great example is the first one up here, Eola Hills Charter School in Amity. It's got students from four different grades in a single classroom, and there's only seven kids in the classroom. That's a very small school. In some of the larger districts, if you go to, say, the top of the second page, Brookings Harbor is not a terribly large district, but you've got a blended 3-4 classroom where there's 13 students in each grade, and so 26 in that classroom. That's a fairly large classroom for those low grades. If you go through here, you'll see generally in larger districts with larger schools, you'll have class sizes of, in the 20s, some of them actually up in the 30s. And you'll see some interesting exceptions. You'll have on the third page the resource link charter school. It's got kindergarten through fifth grade all in one classroom with a total of 16 students. So got a lot of variation going on, but the most common occurrence is two grades in one classroom and class sizes in the low to mid to upper 20s is probably the norm for the blended classrooms in Oregon. If you look on the very last page, what it shows you is that there are 131 where we had good data classrooms with just shy of 3,000 students in them and an average class size of 21.5. So I don't know if you have any questions about these or whether you want to look at it for a while and then maybe have questions, but I'm happy to answer any of those you have.
Anne, I believe you were the one that asked for the blended class size. Were there any questions that you had at this time?
Actually, I believe it was...
Or was it Jeff? Maybe it was Jeff.
I have my committee members in front of me, but I thought it was the second grade teacher from Forest Grove.
Jeff is owning up to it right now.
Yep. That was my request. You know, I guess one of the things that jumped out as me as well as this notion of multiple spans, like the first through fifth or what have you, and you know, a lot of those scenarios centered around the smaller charter, smaller types of classes, and yet I, regardless of what the split is at a certain point, to me there has to be some impact to teaching in the standard-based world, right? If you're a third and fourth grade teacher, you're delivering assessments at a certain point, high-stakes assessments, and yet you need to meet the needs of both of those separate grade levels, and I think that becomes definitely more difficult in this blended world, you know, again, when I just looked through it, I in my head, I'm thinking, that is a juggle. I mean, the administrators who have to work with the enrollments that they have and balance out classrooms, I mean, that is a struggle. And I don't know where the don't know where the give is in that to avoid blended or split classrooms. You're either going to have to, you're going to have to hire a lot of folks and be really satisfied and okay with, like, how do you have a classroom of nine? Quandary. So just makes me more confused in some ways.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you bringing this, Mr. Reeder, and I appreciate your comments, so thank you. Anybody else? Yes, please.
I will say that it is another good example of large number size. 3,000 kids is a fairly good size in, and you came within one person of the same class size as our state average. So it is pretty unique that when you start doing it, even though like some of them were 8 and 9 kids, others were 33, the average came out to the same, pretty close to the same as our state average, higher than the national average, all those kinds of things, which goes to tell you that one of the problems with averaging things is that it doesn't tell the complete story. And this one is truly 21 per teacher because it's based on classrooms. This one over here, the one we got earlier, as was explained by Brian, is made up of all of the people who have a teaching certificate in the particular school divided into the number, which always makes it look less. You know, when you sell this number out to the public and they say, wow, 22.1, that's not too bad. And then they go and look in their schools and they say, I can't find any of those classes that are 22.2. How did that come out? But they don't realize that any counselor, any PE special, any of the specialists, any of the even administrators in some of those results, depending on the state, because they hold a certificate, become part of the number of people they divide by. So it makes those numbers less relevant to the real conversation we're having about how many kids are sitting in that classroom with an instructor. So.
Thank
I think
you.
It's informative,
it
just looking at the two, to remind us that when you're talking about class size, it's very different from what we actually think it is.
I appreciate those comments. Anybody else have another issue or another comment to make or a question on this information? Brian has been really, really busy. Are there any other questions from last time that you felt we have not answered? Okay. And I really appreciate the fact that while he was working on the quality education model report that he has to do every 2 years, and it was due yesterday, that he was continuing to work on some work for this particular group, and I want to thank him for that. Would you like to highlight, because we talked about last time we wanted to wait till your report was done, but do you want to highlight anything that you think stood out to you as far as the report this year, as far as important information, or items that you think relate to some of the conversation we've had in the last two meetings?
Regarding the quality education?
Yes.
You know, there's really, I don't think, a lot there that directly applies to this task force, other than the fact that, you know, we have in elementary schools, we have average class sizes in the area of 23 to 24, and the model recommends somewhat lower than that, not dramatically lower, but on average a little bit lower. But as Senator Roblin pointed out, those averages are don't really tell us everything we need to know. Within that average, we've got, and you can see it in here, even in these blended ones, is that we have a lot of classrooms that are in the low teens, in the mid-teens, and then we have a lot of them that are in the mid and upper 20s. And so to bring those, with the model recommending class sizes of 20 in kindergarten and first grade and about 22 or 23 in the rest of the elementary grades, being at 28 or 29 or 30 is considerably higher than that. And that's really, if we think that bringing those class sizes down has merit, then that's where the focus needs to be, on those classrooms where it's so high relative to, you know, where we want it to be, which is in the low 20s. So the averages don't tell us really what we need to know.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes, Senator.
So you hear from people that the quality education model was developed back in the 90s, so it's not relevant. Does the commission continue to update and look at it and reevaluate the model as the years go by to keep it more in line with what we believe today from the research?
It does. I mean, the commission does really two things, two major things each round. And the model is, and the report run on a two-year cycle, so the report comes out in August before the long session of the legislature, so August of even-numbered years. And in each two-year cycle, the commission looks at the what we call the costing model, which is the part that looks at the amount of money that Oregon's currently spending on its schools, what it's spending it on, and how much more is needed to, the way the commission puts it, to meet our academic goals as stated in law. And right now those academic goals are focused primarily around high school graduation, but what that implies is better results starting all the way back in kindergarten and actually starting all the way back in pre-K. And so the commission looks at the research on how, for example, better results in kindergarten and more resources in kindergarten affect results later on, and how that in turn affects high school graduation. And we're actually trying to look at post-secondary success also. What we see is, even when high school graduation rates go up, we don't necessarily see higher enrollment rates in college or higher persistence rates in college. And so it's not just about graduating from high school, it's also about being prepared to do well after high school, no matter where the students end up.
So you've taken into consideration the 40-40-20 expectations of the state.
Exactly. And so we try to keep up with the national research and research from other states, but we also try to do analysis of our own, which is primarily done at the department and by consultants. The last 2 years we've been working with the Education Policy Innovation Center that's in Eugene, known as EPIC, looking at college readiness issues. So I would argue that the commission does a good job of staying up with the research and tweaking the model as needed to make it relevant for where we are today. If someone says, the model's too old, well, models are only old if you ignore them. And so we don't do that. We update the model every 2 years. And so I think it's relevant. The commission has kept it relevant over that entire period.
Yes, please.
This last biennium, which we're in now, we have made some major reinvestments in education, dollar-wise. Did we get any closer to the expectations necessary to meet the expectations of the quality education model?
Yeah, if you take a look at the report, the prior report, which came out in 2014, estimated that we needed to invest $2.3 billion more above what we call the current service level, which is where we were at the time in terms of our funding. Well, in 13-15, at the time we were looking at the 15-17 biennium, so a $2.3 billion gap based on the current service level. Well, the legislature actually appropriated considerably more than the current service level, so the gap was actually closer to $1.8 billion. So about $600 million that we reduced that gap in the 2015 legislative session. Right now, to maintain that level of funding, in other words, the current service level, we're estimating the gap in 17-19 to be about $1.99 billion, I think. So
the gap did widen slightly, because what you're saying.
Yeah, only slightly, but the reason is that we shrunk the gap considerably, and,
right.
And now it's gone back up. Now, if the legislature is able to invest more than the current service level again, then that gap can close.
Right.
The question is, will there be resources to do that? So we need to remember that when the Quality Education Commission estimates the gap, we don't know yet what the legislature is going to do in the coming session. The estimated gap is based on what would happen if the legislature simply kept up with inflation. And if they can do better than that,
can I get a question?
The gap will close.
Absolutely. Could you please give your name
right
there? Thank you, Paula.
I have 2 points. One, when you consider reduce the gap, keeping in mind, just to answer the senator's question, we also implemented full-day kindergarten that year, so any money that was helping to reduce it really got eaten up by districts having to go to a full-day kindergarten program, so nothing went to class size. And then the second thing is I didn't get the report since I'm not there of the current QEM. Can you just real quick tell me again the numbers that the QEM recommends for class size in this current rollout?
They haven't really changed. The recommendations are 20 for kindergarten and first grade. I think for second and third grade, it's either 22 or 23. And for fourth and fifth grade, it's 24. And
wow. Okay, thank you.
And along that lines, did the quality...
No, sorry, to follow up. Do you know also, yeah. When we're looking at this class size stuff, I just want to make sure I was just at my building with the principal. We were talking about anywhere in the QAM, does it mention poverty schools being a different configuration for class size or all the same?
No, it doesn't recommend different class sizes for schools that have more students in poverty. Remember that the QEM is based on what we call prototype schools, and so it's a school that sort of looks like the statewide average. So I think one way to interpret that is if you have higher poverty than the statewide average, then one way to use additional resources is to have lower class sizes. If you're at lower poverty than the statewide average, then perhaps you can get by with slightly higher class sizes. Class size would be one way. Reducing class sizes would be one way to serve students, higher poverty students, more effectively. But there are other ways to do that as well. And so the model doesn't make specific recommendations about how to use more resources to serve those students.
Does the model?
I have a follow-up question.
Okay. Go ahead.
Is this Paula again, or is this Annie? Ann?
This is Ann.
Thank you.
I'm wondering how the model treats, and in fact, and I hope that we'll put up the link to this report on our task force website so it's easily accessible for us there. But in addition, I was wondering if the model, how it treats class size at the high school level. Is it actual number of students in a class? Or do we think of it more in terms of a student load per teacher? If they're teaching different numbers of sections, sometimes that seems to be the more important figure for teachers than actually how many people might be sitting in a given class.
Yeah, in the middle and high schools, the model doesn't talk about teacher load in terms of students. It talks about teacher load in terms of how many periods they teach per day. So in essence, it says they have a planning period. And, in a seven period day, they would teach I think six classes. In an eight period day, they would probably still teach six, so that they have enough planning time. That's adequate for the number of courses they're teaching. What the model does recommend is that the maximum class size in core classes be 29. And if you think you've seen a lot of variation in class sizes in elementary schools, wait until you look at even within a given high school. It's enormous depending on what the class is. So some electives will be very small. Some other courses will be very large. PE classes tend to be pretty large. Obviously, things like theater and band can be pretty large relative to what we think of as a typical class size. But in the core classes, math, writing, literature, and maybe language is not necessarily a core class, but the recommendation there is that they be a maximum of 29. Now there may be some work that could be done on the model to look at teacher loads that might make sense. That is one of the things that high school teachers talk about a lot, is how many individual students they are responsible for. And even if class sizes are not terribly large, it can still be overwhelming to have too many students for one-on-one and individualized instruction.
So the question is, does the model now include full-day kindergarten?
Yes, it does.
That's what I thought. So.
The other thing that actually added a certain amount to the cost, although it doesn't add to the gap because it applies both in the what we call the base case, which is where we are now, and the recommended case, is that the PERS rate is expected to go up again in 17-19 by about 3.5 percentage points. So that adds cost to the system, both in the base case and in the what we call the full QEM case, fully implemented case. But it does add more in the fully implemented case because that case has more teachers in it. So when you add a teacher, it's not just their salary, it's also that higher level of benefits as well.
Thank you for clearing that up. I appreciate the comments and questions. Are there any other comments and questions on this particular portion of the agenda, the quality education model? Well, I want to make one comment, and that is I think that that Senator Roblin made a very good question that led me to thinking about a couple of things. Number one, if we're going to continue to put this on the books and make Mr. Reeder do a report every 2 years and make sure that the legislature has an awareness of what some of the some of the successes are and hopefully some of the challenges are that we're still addressing. I think it's important for us, you know, to do something with the report. And so my feeling is that, you know, as we're talking today, that again, you talked about some of the solutions for poverty schools might be tweaking some of the sizes of, you know, the classes. Another solution could be as we talk about what we do with the quality education model as we go forward and what we expect the legislature and or the staff and the Department of Ed to really be considering as we go forward with these reports every year. Because I've only seen two reports now and I haven't read this last one, but it's a situation where if all that good information is there, we should have some, I think, you know, opportunity to try and figure out how to finesse results. Senator?
We do have a separate committee that meets, and we have the staff of that committee sitting right here. but actually takes the report and has a small discussion about it, but it's been pretty clear. Oregon, as opposed to Washington, Washington has a similar issue, but they were found in contempt of court. So they're paying $100,000 a day fine for not having funded education. Our court decided that we had to acknowledge the report, look at it, and give an example of why we can't. And an example would be that we don't have the money. And that works in our state. In Washington, it did not. They have decided that since all the money from the fines go to the education anyway, it's still cheaper to pay the fine than it is to funded at the level, and they're about $2 billion short as well, a little over. So it's been an interesting conversation with my friends from Washington.
Thank you for clearing that up.
The same thing. So we do talk about it. I would not say this the last time we talked a little longer than we usually do, because we had to rewrite some stuff. But so it does have a discussion.
That's wonderful. So you know. And I hope that.
And you're welcome to join. Talk to your speaker
okay.
And ask if you want to be on that committee.
Okay, that sounds committee. Like a good idea. We could put that in my report, too. Okay. Any other questions, please, on this? Yes, Jeff.
So to maybe ask a little bit about assessment, Brian, you talked about the impacts of kindergarten achievement. What kind of markers were you using to in reference to that, I guess?
Well, we have we don't have any measures of we don't have any assessments that the state for which the state gets data for kindergarten. What we have is an assessment that's done when students arrive at kindergarten. It was initially called the Kindergarten Readiness Assessment, but for reasons I'm not aware of, the term readiness was taken out, so now it's just called the kindergarten assessment. But it's assessment when they come into kindergarten, not when they leave, or not sometime during the kindergarten year. And it's intended to understand, you know, where the students are at when they arrive in kindergarten. And then the next standardized assessment that is a statewide assessment is in the third grade. And so we look at assessments in each of the grades where students take them. And then we currently almost have enough data to follow students all the way through, follow an individual student all the way through school to high school graduation. And so understanding some of the factors in the early grades and how they're correlated with whether or not a student graduates from high school or not is something that we've started looking at very carefully. And so it's this student-level data really is very helpful in understanding those things. What we haven't been able to do is know in terms of class sizes, we don't know the class sizes that each student is in over those years, because this class size collection that we just started 2 years ago, that was the first time we have it at the student level. So in the past, we just had... we knew what the class sizes were in a given school, but we didn't know which students were in those classes. So, you know, one thing that I'm really excited about with this recent data is we can't follow kids over time yet, but we can look across the state at the variation in class sizes and see if the students who are in those class, you know, given their characteristics, And we can look at both their demographics and some of their achievement scores on standardized assessments to see if we see much variation. You know, in essence, to see if we, if there's any impact of smaller class sizes on student achievement, while at the same time taking into account other factors such as their demographics and the size of their school and things like that.
And again, I would just be precautionary and say when using markers of success, being it's high school graduation or it's a high stakes test. I mean, again, there are other ways to measure success. There are multiple ways to assess. And again, I mean, one of the things I'm hoping will come about somewhere down the line with what we do in education is look at the variety of things that go into what makes a successful student or outcome, and at what point do we start to kind of consider, you know, how does one make adjustments for their learning and growth from their failures? I mean, I know personally, again, my own life says my best learning sometimes comes from my failures, right? That's why you encourage kids to keep at it and move forward and, you know, learn from their mistakes. That's why we give feedback, right? And yet when we place so much emphasis on markers, I think that could be lost and is lost.
There is one item that I would like to just remind us about, and that was that when we were looking at work in both the first and the second meeting, we all agreed that we weren't just necessarily looking at a number, that we were looking at other issues that could be important, that seems from at least some of the stories that we heard from actual people in the classrooms, that the number is as it affects safety. The number is as it affects the ability to give feedback. The number as it is actually affecting the quality teaching techniques that you can use. The number as it is actually dealing with what we call relationships and importance between the teacher and the student as far as having that relationship. So I think when we talk about, you know, the reports, I know it's easier on a statistical abstract to look at just the number, but we were looking at the number as it affects issues and other items that we know are important in success of teaching and students. So I want us not to get all...
Representative?
Yes.
You know, I'm so glad that you brought that up.
It reminded me of a relatively
current data set that Oregon has been participating in that I think would be one last piece that would be really helpful to inform our discussion. Oregon teachers have been surveyed through the TEL survey in 2014 and 2016, and I think the information that we have gathered there could really help inform our discussion of class size. The very first question asks teachers if their class sizes are reasonable so that they have the time available to meet the needs of all students. As I've looked at a few pieces of this information, there's strong correlation between teachers' perceptions of class size and their other ability to educate students in a way that provides a safe environment, that gives them the instructional time that they need. All of those factors seem to correlate directly to how satisfied they are with their class size. And I don't know if Brian can correlate some of this information school by school with the class size information that he has, but it's an important data set of teacher perception of how learning is happening in the classroom that's widely available now that I think it would be worth making available for committee members to take a look at if they're not familiar with it already.
I appreciate that. Is this Ann or Paula?
Sorry, it is Ann.
Okay, Ann, thank you very much. And we'll try to get that TEL survey and see if we can get it on the website. are on the, thank you.
I guess one thing I would say, and I agree wholeheartedly with Jeffrey's comments, is that the hard data that we collect, that school districts and the state collect, only tells us a little bit of the story, and understanding all of these other things that are, they're more difficult to quantify, but they are observable. And trying to understand how we can better use information about, you know, how teachers relate to their students, how having setbacks, you know, what do students learn from that, and what do they take from that can be positive. Those are things that we're getting more and more research from psychologists and brain researchers and a really broad range of people that goes so much beyond just looking at class sizes and standardized test scores and those sorts of things. And so bringing both kinds of analysis together, I think, has a lot of promise for teaching us more interesting and useful things about how to improve our teaching. I don't want to imply that simply because much of my work is quantitative that the qualitative part is unimportant. It, particularly in teaching kids, it's extremely important. It's just much more difficult to get at.
Thank you very much. Yes, please.
And that is the art of administration in a school building, in that you get your dollars based on a formula, and then you have to decide how to do those dollars. And as a math teacher, when I was teaching, I didn't want 30 kids in my arithmetic class, so kids who had not been successful in math for 9 years, and I didn't mind having 35 in my Algebra 2 class for a whole lot of reasons, including the fact that my Algebra 2 kids, they can wait to get reinforced. My arithmetic kids could not wait. I mean, if they got it wrong and they didn't get somebody there to help them with it, they gave up. My advanced kids, they would work through it even if they didn't get the answer. They'd go find somebody else to get them the answer because they had a different motivation. So everything you're saying is absolutely true. It's just figuring out, and the thing that's nice from my perspective about the model is that these are prototype schools that are smaller in general than what we regularly have for schools in general, which means that the averages are real averages because the schools are average. And so once you get away from the average, you've got to do other kinds of things to balance those things. And that's really, really true in all aspects. So
we talked a little bit about that, the idea of the size of the school and the old, you know, the old new concept of school within a school.
Right.
You know? And those types of things to try to create that image of small, that feeling of belonging. You know, those types of things I think are definitely part of what was discussed at least one meeting ago and very important. So thank you. At this point, are there any other questions or any other comments that the committee would like to make on the quality education model? We will continue to gather information and research, and so if you have research that has not been shared in the first three meetings, please let's talk to the staff or myself to make sure we can get something up online if it's something that's available that we think is important and we missed, and then we can go on to trying to figure out what we're going to do with some of our comments, thoughts, and ideas. Yes, sir.
Would you like me then to wait and provide that information later, or would you like me to provide that information?
I think we talked a little bit about that. I think you should talk about it now.
My committee members, I apologize for not being here the last two meetings. My name is Darren Drill, the superintendent of Cascade School District. If you went to the Enchanted Forest or Water Valley Vineyards, then you've been in my school district. We are literally the middle-sized school district in the state. We are actually right at 2,300 kids, and we fit right in there. We also, thank you, Brian, for reminding me how Cascade did in the split classroom situation, because we're there. If you look on page 3 of the report that Brian gave you, it shows Turner Elementary, shows the average class size at 33, 33, and 32. Unfortunately, that is the result of 2 years ago winning the national or the state title award for improvement in schools. So we get all kinds of people that want to show up. We have found that split in those class sizes has actually been helpful, not hurtful. It did, Jeffrey, you make a good point about that. It did require some additional training for our staff. But the reality is in my classrooms that don't split classes. They are still trying to figure out how to handle the lowest rankage to the highest rankage. So the reality is we're already doing that anyway. But I appreciate that, to take a look at those numbers. We've tried to turn that on its head. By the way, Cascade School District's average graduation rate is right at 90% for the year, so we're running right about there. I asked Representative McLean, and I wasn't sure where you guys were with regard to some research. It's not the greatest light with regard to class size if you're hoping to make class sizes smaller. However, I think it's important that you know that, because most of us in education do pay attention to John Hattie, who wrote a number of meta studies around how to make kids learn better. And one of the things he did, and over the last 20 years he's done that, up until this last year, he now has 12 meta studies, 70,000 studies in itself, and 300 million students worldwide that he has evaluated. What I'm going to hand to you is his appendix on effective class or effective sizes, about certain different details that are used in classrooms to make a better effect on how kids learn. There's 150 of them. Unfortunately, I apologize, I was sick last week, so I'm trying to work through this. Class size in and of itself is number 113. It's fairly low on his scale of what's important and what's not important. Now, that said, because I'm an advocate of smaller class size, it's in relationship to a number of other things, obviously. But that's an important piece. So I want to make sure that it's in there to provide the balance. I've got enough copies for you guys. On the back, he has a barometer of influence about what is negative, what is low, what is medium, and what is high. You can get either one of his books. It's easy to find. John Hattie has, like I said, in 2009, and then again in 16, he came out with two other researchers that put things together with regard to what is truly important in the classroom. So, Representative McLean, thank you for letting me just, I'll pass these out, and we make sure we get those on the list. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Drell. At this point, then, if there's no other information that needs to be added, what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and we're going to close the informational part of our meeting, and then we will open a public hearing on class size and effects of class size. And I think that's really important, that we are remembering that we're not just talking about class size for the fact that, you know, we have so many people in a room. We're talking about the effects that it might have on teaching styles, learning styles, safety, relationships, and all of those other types of things that we've discussed so far. So at this point, I have a list of folks who have come and are willing to testify. And we have a chair over here on the end and the mic set up for you. And so I'm just going to take them in the order that you wrote your name down. And first we have Jean Trowbridge. And if you would just come up and introduce yourself as far as who you are, where you teach, or what you do in the classroom, or what you do in the school system, and we'll go from there.
Jan's up and walking, and I saw that you had put this pedestal for her in the middle. So did we want Jan to get there now? No, I'm getting a bad time. Yeah. There was a pedestal there, and I figured it had to be for you, Jan.
It was probably for you, yes.
Okay. Hi. My name is Jean Trowbridge, and I am an elementary school teacher in the Reynolds School District. I appreciate this opportunity to talk about class size, especially as it relates to kindergarten and first grade, and especially as it relates to children living with high levels of stress and trauma. And I'd like to approach this issue from a variety of perspectives, as a parent, a teacher, an advocate, and oddly enough, from a business perspective. So first, as a parent, I observed the impact our state tax structure had on Portland public school system. My oldest child recently turned 30, and when he was enrolled in kindergarten, he had 22 students and a teacher and a full-time EA. 7 years later, my youngest student had the same teacher, 25 kids in the class, and no EA. So the opportunities my son had were very different than those of my daughter in a classroom where the teacher-student ratio was 1 to 11 rather than 1 to 25. Every student had an opportunity in the lower ratios, every student had an opportunity to interact with the adult on a regular basis. The teacher was also able to incorporate experiences such as cooking into the curriculum because there was another adult who could supervise measuring, mixing, hot plates, and other cooking equipment. And there was more support available for math and literacy. Whole group activities could run more smoothly because there was another adult who could support students who were having a difficult time settling down. My daughter did not have these same opportunities. Secondly, as a teacher, I have never taught in a kindergarten or first grade classroom with a full-time year-long assistant. I've had as many as 32 kindergartners assigned to my classroom, and the high number of students has led me to change the way I run my classroom and interact with students. I often cannot have a traditional circle time because the space in the room does not allow 30 wiggly 5-year-olds to sit down safely together. Students are limited by the amount of time that I can spend with them independently. With 30 students and a 45-minute math block, I could spend 10 or 15 minutes on whole group instruction and then allocate an average of 1 or 2 minutes to check in with each student, essentially establish a continuous loop around the classroom that lets me see what's going on. This does not provide the support students need as they are learning challenging new math concepts. It's also not very realistic. Every child has different needs, and the staff-student ratio does not allow for these differences. This past year, I had 2 students in particular who required an enormous amount of one-on-one attention. One child already demonstrated a strong grasp of math concepts we were exploring, but would not focus during our independent working time, and his behavior impacted other students' abilities to focus on their learning. His family life was chaotic. He was feeling a lot of sibling rivalry, and he would not work unless an adult was sitting next to him. Another child was struggling with shifting abstract thoughts into concrete skills. Her family life was stable and supportive, but she would shut down when confronted with perceived failure. She could not easily see her own strengths and skills, and to support her learning, I would have to sit and wait for her to move into a receptive state and then take that opportunity to highlight her thinking process and show her that she had done the work on her own to build her confidence and to take a risk and try something hard. Both of these students needed more than 2 minutes of my time to grow as learners, and so did the other 25 students in my class. I started advocating for children in high-stress situations over 20 years ago when I worked in a domestic violence shelter. There were no programs for children at the shelter because funding was tied to services provided to the adults and because of the belief that, well, they're just children, they'll adjust, they'll do fine. Recently, Kaiser Permanente and the Centers for Disease Control completed the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, a study that ties adult health issues to childhood experiences. My school's community is faced with many of these adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. 100% of the students qualify for free meals. In every classroom, there is at least one child who does not have stable housing. Many families are impacted by job insecurity, crime, drugs, or alcohol. Additionally, up to 80% of our kindergarten students have never been in a structured social environment before. No licensed childcare, no head start. And as an advocate for these students, I believe they deserve and require the support that low teacher-student ratios can provide. While I may have wanted my daughter to have the same opportunities as my son did, she was going to be fine regardless. But kids that are coming from other environments don't have the benefits that my children had. We know that the students in higher income communities have resources and supports that children in poverty do not have. We have the opportunity to give these children additional support through smaller class sizes. Students in high ACEs communities need smaller staff to student ratios to provide the opportunity to build a relationship with an adult in a stable, secure setting. When parents are overstressed from trying to find safe, secure housing, adequate food and clothing, a job that will support a family, they may not have the personal resources left to work on homework and to support their child's social and academic skills. During conferences this past spring, I was eating lunch with another teacher and wondering why a kindergarten student was sobbing on the floor of the office. The principal was sitting on the floor next to him, talking about how there was no school today, that his teacher was busy, that he could come back after conferences, and he continued to cry, saying that he just wanted to go to sleep there on the office floor. We were wondering why his mom didn't just scoop him up and take him home for a nap. During a conversation afterwards, we learned that this family was currently living in the new family shelter, a large open room with cots, no walls, no doors, no privacy, and over 100 adults and children. There was no quiet, safe place for this mother to take her exhausted child, And when conferences were over, this child had to return to a classroom with one teacher and 25 classmates. His social, emotional, never mind academic needs cannot be met when his teacher can only devote 2 minutes to him personally during each subject area. And for a paradigm shift, I'd like to talk about staff-student ratios from a business perspective. I don't believe that business models can be applied to educational settings. For one thing, public schools cannot interview, screen, and choose the students that show the highest level of skill and knowledge. Public schools work with every student that lives within their enrollment boundaries. But since business concepts are often applied to public school settings, I would encourage people to think about small class size through a business structure, the span of control. How many people should a supervisor be responsible for in order to maximize output? The higher the intellectual cognitive challenge, the smaller the span of control. Toyota discovered that their engineers work best with a 1-to-12 ratio. GE determined that no manager should have more than 15 people reporting to them. And on the sports side, the University of Oregon football team has 99 players and 20 staff. All of these examples are working with highly trained, highly motivated, highly paid adults with fully developed prefrontal cortexes, people who've already learned how to collaborate, cooperate, and work independently. I cannot think of a more challenging intellectual task than that faced by 5- and 6-year-old children. How to take playing with blocks and turn it into engineering concepts and math equations. How to take our spoken language and link sounds to specific squiggles so that you can read and write. How to share, how to collaborate, how to cooperate, how to work with others, how to have empathy for others, how to work through failure, how to be patient. The foundations for these skills start in the kindergarten and first grade classroom, yet the staff-to-student ratio, the span of control, is often double or triple what can be found in the business community. The challenges mentioned above are all compounded by the concentrations of student needs. I think this came up when we talked about averages versus reality. When and where the challenges of hunger and homelessness, crime and addictions are concentrated, the needs of the school increase exponentially. The concentration of need must be met with a concentration of resources, and the first step can be a small class size or a low teacher-to-student ratio.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I started out by not giving any kind of a time limit, which has to be, you know, unheard of. But I want to thank you for your testimony, and I want you to feel free to provide us with a written copy if you'd like us to have it with the record.
Lori, we'll
and be happy to do that.
Okay.
And there are only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people who have signed up today. So since I gave her no time, I will make sure that the rest of you have an opportunity to come up and really give us your thoughts. But remember that all of us have to get through traffic at the end of the day, right? So here we go.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much, Jean. And I'll ask Kathy Newman next.
Hi. First of all, thank you for allowing me the time today to share my perspective on why class size does matter. My name is Kathy Newman. I am currently a sixth grade teacher. I have taught for over 25 years in Hillsboro, and I have taught first grade through sixth grade, so I have a wide variety of experiences in class configurations. In preparing for today, I was trying to whittle down the myriad of reasons why class size matters. And the first thing I thought about was the extra workload for educators. 1 year, and I'll keep referencing this particular example rather than, because there are many examples that we could all use. I went from having 24 students in my classroom to 36 the following year. 36 of a split classroom, 5th and 6th grade students. So the workload alone, papers that I had to grade, essays to evaluate, parent communications, the whole thing, was up 50%, my workload did. Then I also thought about the health and safety considerations around large class sizes. One example being a colleague that I had who is still recuperating 2 years after a fall in the classroom due to crowded conditions. But I decided to focus instead on the experiences of the students because they are, after all, the ones that I think are losing out in this game of numbers. First, we are all aware that we have more rigorous standards that educators and students are working to meet. Our students have been working really hard to try to rise to these new standards, but it takes a lot of work. Students need deep, meaningful practice and quality verbal and written feedback. They are learning how to do things in different ways with different expectations. The additional individual attention that is needed is probably not happening at a level that teachers or students find adequate. Our children are missing out. Many teachers are scrambling to find new, updated, rigorous, relevant materials to offer students. Many districts have been unable financially to keep up with this, so teachers have been forced to scour the web to find companion pieces to existing materials or to find and create new curriculum and lessons. I personally love this aspect of the job, but there aren't enough hours in the day to do this work, as well as the time needed to assess student work, to plan and tweak subsequent lessons to address the needs that we see based on their current work. The fact that you have 36 students instead of 24 students makes this all the more unrealistic. Our children are missing out. The new standards demand new and different technologies be used and experienced. For example, elementary students need to read multiple pieces, watch and listen to videos, and then synthesize all of this information to construct meaningful answers to questions on a computer. This is not only a huge issue of equity for students, which is a totally different issue, but educators are finding it nearly impossible to teach to the new technology needed to be successful when you have large classes, both in content and infrastructure. The year that my colleague and I had 36 and 38 students, respectively, when we got to the computer lab during our allotted time, several of the students had to double up with others. But even if we had the infrastructure, students still need the time and the individual attention to receive meaningful technology instruction and practice. Our students are missing out. Students are feeling the impacts of class size challenges in other ways. I have talked to science teachers who discontinued a good number of labs due to safety and space concerns. Teachers would love to engage students in more engineering and hands-on projects, but due to space and material constraints, projects are modified or eliminated. My students got less of the messy arts, painting and sculpting with clay, etc., due to space, time, and materials. I would go back to the example of having the 50% more students. Just the additional time to clean up from those art projects was so much time to do that it meant there was actually less time to do the art. So I eventually had to cut the amount as well as the quality of those lessons. Other lost opportunities my students have experienced due to large class sizes included fewer field trips. Previously, we were able to get two classrooms onto one bus. With the large classes, we were only able to get one class on a bus, which doubled our field trip transportation costs. And curriculum. I was unable to meet the curriculum needs of the students. When I had fifth and sixth graders with very different social study curriculums, just as one example, something had to get cut out. So the social studies curriculum got short shifted that year. And less small group and individual attention was given. Our children are missing out. Another casualty due to large class sizes includes our most important partners, parents and legal guardians. When I mentioned the 50% increase in student load, the thing to keep in mind is that the 50% doesn't just represent that one individual student alone. Each student comes with their own little system of parents and siblings and extended family, and I really try to get to know those parents and families because I know that that system has a direct impact on that student's success in school. 24 or 25 systems are manageable. Over 30, not so much. The result? Parents received less communication, or the communication received was very short. I focused on the high flyers. I had to cut out the happy news. There were fewer newsletters and class-wide communication, where the communication that did go out was a one-size-fits-all, as opposed to individual follow-up and verbal progress updates to parents on individual student concerns. Our children are missing out. In the past few years, we have at our school, and I've been told this is a statewide issue, experienced a large number of our youngest students with out-of-control behaviors, behaviors that have compromised the safety and learning of the classroom. It is sad when room clears are not an uncommon occurrence. We are told that this is due to the high number of students that have experienced or are experiencing trauma in their lives. The statistic we are cited is that 1 out of 5 students have experienced or are experiencing trauma in their lives. Some of these students act out, but many of them are the silent sufferers, the students that internalize or keep their trauma silent. When faced with large numbers of or large class sizes of 30 students or more, it's nearly impossible to address or even identify the needs of these traumatized students. Unfortunately, the focus is on the explosive or outwardly expressive child. But each time there's an uncontrolled outburst, whether it's a student throwing a chair or materials, a child screaming and crying, yelling profanities, threatening, hurting someone in the classroom, those silent trauma victims are being victimized again and again. In my district, this has been an ongoing concern. This coming year, my school will be 1 of 5 in the district piloting a new trauma-informed classroom model that I am very hopeful about. But I did notice in the description of what the program entails and what additional resources that we would receive that nowhere was class size addressed. While I have high hopes to learn from and work with this model, I worry about the efficacy of what we are doing when you pack in one room 29 to 30 or more first and second graders, which is what we're scheduled to do this next year, and with the knowledge that you have a very unique social and emotional makeup of those children. Our children are missing out. My final observation, after many years of teaching, is around student test scores. Now, so far, I have found that my students were able to maintain growth as measured by test scores, despite the large class sizes. So far, I haven't seen this year's results again until fall. Unfortunately, I have heard people say to me that, well, since your students are making gains or maintaining scores with those large class sizes, then class size doesn't matter. But they are only seeing the test scores, a very narrow window into the experiences of students for that year. That year that I had the 36 and 37 fifth and sixth graders, there was a lot that people did not see. They didn't see the fewer field trips, those experiences that might have excited and sparked a passion for some or helped others understand and get that aha moment. They didn't see the loss of science and art projects. They didn't notice that the science experiments were more teacher demonstrations rather than hands-on discovery. They didn't see the reduction of meaningful dialogue and constructive debates with small groups of students, where I was able to get around and hear their thinking and prompt further discussion. They didn't see the additional stress on the children when they couldn't get the individual attention they needed, questions answered, or explanations at their level of understanding. They didn't see the diminished quality of feedback to individual papers or projects. I could go on, but I think you get the picture. Test scores are an imperfect way to negate the impact of class sizes. So as I close, I have tried to steer clear of talking about workload implications to teachers. I have tried to not discuss our health and safety implications, and I tried to present from how the students are impacted. But as you can see, it is all intertwined. Our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. So for me, there is one reoccurring theme. Our children are missing out. Thank you for listening, and thank you for doing this important work.
Thank you, Kathy. I appreciate your comments, and please feel free to turn those in if you'd like. Okay. Now we have, is it Kirsten Manning?
You'll have to excuse my voice. It's a little shaky. Long laryngitis. I think it's a teacher thing. But thank you for having me here today. I'm honored to speak to you about my experience as a teacher. My name is Kirsten Manning, and I am a teacher in the Salem-Keizer School District, currently teaching reading intervention at Hoover Elementary School. But I'm a lot more than that. I am the daughter of teachers. I am the wife of a teacher. And I have the I am the mother of three children currently enrolled in public schools. Education and the state of it permeates all aspects of my life. Before I discuss class size and its impact on my own teaching experience, I would like to share a bit, thank you, about my family. I am the mother of three amazing children, and they are all special to me, but today I would like to discuss my youngest child with you. He's currently 7 years old, but pretty much since he was born, I knew there was something different about him. He cried nonstop. He didn't eat much. He was terrified of new people and places. He was sensitive to lights, sounds, smells, and other stimuli. At age two, he was diagnosed as having a sensory processing disorder. This particular condition means that his brain does not process sensory information like other brains do. The filters that would help him when music is too loud and lights are too bright or smells are too strong just does not exist in his brain. He gets everything all at once. Because of this, his early years were very overwhelming. He didn't like crowded spaces, loud noises, or many kinds of food. Now, we had resources. He went to counseling, he went to occupational therapy and private preschool. But he became agitated when someone sat too close to him at preschool, and he sometimes became aggressive and he bit children. He had to learn to stay calm in overwhelming situations. He learned to integrate, but he's still a sensitive guy and frequently very anxious. Now imagine this is your child. And imagine you take him to his first day of first grade, and there are 30 children in his classroom. Imagine 36-year-olds in one room all day long. Just picture that. Children that age are active, they're noisy, and they have shorter attention spans. And for some of them, as for my son, first grade is their first public school experience. Now imagine that by the end of that week, that classroom enrollment had grown to 34 children, and it stayed that way all year. His teacher was offered 2 extra hours a day of instructional assistant time to assist with the extra load, but that was all. So research tells us that the ideal number of children in a classroom for grades K-3 is less than 20. One of the largest studies, the study of Tennessee's Project STAR, was randomized and allowed children to have small class sizes for 4 years before studying differences in achievement with the control group of students that had larger class sizes. The findings were that students in smaller class sizes had a better learning outcome than the control group by as much as a quarter of a standard deviation, which means that a student who would have been in the 50th percentile on a standardized test could now be in the 60th percentile, and that's a significant gain. Furthermore, students could instead, or students from minority and poverty backgrounds had the largest overall gains, as much as double their control group peers. Finally, the more years spent in reduced classes, the longer lasting the benefits were. I must point out, however, that in Tennessee's Project STAR, a small classroom was 17 or less. In this study, a classroom of 22 to 26 was considered a large classroom and less than ideal. However, where I work in the Salem-Keizer School District, we are staffed at 26 students per teacher at grades K-3 and 28 students per teacher at grades 4 and 5. And I know that Salem-Keizer is not alone in its large class sizes, but I myself have never taught any year where I had less than 26 students. And according to research, that is much too large. Now let's get back to that classroom of 34 6-year-olds, which according to research cited above is now double the recommended amount for optimal incomes. Imagine any 6-year-old in this scenario. The room is packed, it's noisy, and it smells like 34 sweaty children. Now imagine a child who cannot filter out sensory information. Imagine the extra noise, the smells, and the crowded space. Picture the visually overwhelming sea of 33 wiggling classmates that he or she sees every day. And that was my child's world this year. In his classroom, he also had children with speech delays, attention deficits, and learning disabilities. And because of the overload, they got less of the teacher's precious time and less instructional time. For those children who were easily overwhelmed, those who were struggling to speak and be heard, those who would have had a hard time focusing even with far fewer classmates, or those for whom learning did not come easily, the effects of overcrowding could be really severe And that's my biggest concern. All children suffer with large class sizes. They all need more. But those who are the most vulnerable and those most likely to drop out later, those most likely to fall behind, and our youngest students, they need reduced class sizes the most. They need a fighting chance at success. Now, I'll tell you, that teacher was amazing. She was patient and kind and worked much harder than she would have had to with fewer children in her care. She sent me progress reports on my boy when he had a particularly good or rough day. She taught him to read, and all his classmates, too. She was admirable under pressure, and her students got her best every day. However, if she continues to have those kinds of numbers year over year, how much longer before she burns out? How much longer before we lose from our ranks an educational superstar? How much better would the year have been for all those children, and particularly those most vulnerable in our system, if she had had fewer children in her care? I think we can do better. Now I can tell you from the flip side what it is like to teach 33 children for a year. I had a year of teaching 33 third graders, crammed into a room designed for far fewer students. I had students of all ability levels. Some read at a fifth grade level, some read at a first grade level, which, by the way, is a pretty standard spread when you teach any grade, about 5 years of differing abilities. Some had learning disabilities and some were considered talented and gifted. It was my job to teach each and every one. It was my job to document that learning, to know about their home lives, to call their homes when their parents requested it or when they were absent for a while. It was my job to know each one and the best way to deliver instruction so that they would understand it. However, that job became exponentially harder with each child delivered to my classroom. First of all, there weren't enough desks. I actually told the office that each time they added a child to my classroom, they needed to also deliver a desk. Second of all, the space was tight. We were packed in with our desks and backpacks, coats and lunches, cubbies, and all our supplies. Children got grumpy with each other because they couldn't easily move about the room, or they got stepped on at carpet time. As the children grew, so did their need for space, but we were just plain out of luck that year. Daily, after the children went home, I would reflect on our time together and wonder things like, well, did I actually talk to Johnny today, or did Susie get what she needed at math time? I was so inundated with the needs of children that I constantly wondered if one was slipping through the cracks. I was hard on myself. I was exhausted. And then there were the neediest children. That was the year that I had a child who, due to early placement in English-only classrooms, had mostly lost his home language of Spanish. At home, he spoke primarily to his brothers and sisters, who were bilingual, in English. Consequently, he could not speak to his own parents, who only spoke Spanish, without the aid of his brothers and sisters acting as interpreters. I scheduled meeting upon meeting to request special education and language evaluation for this boy, and he finally got it in May. There was another boy who came to my classroom at age 9, still misspelling his own name. This, to me, was an obvious red flag of a deeper issue, but I had to navigate his custodial issues to meet with both parents in order to get him tested for special education, which still hadn't happened by the end of the school year when he went into yet another crowded classroom. There was the child who was homeless and falling farther behind in school. There was also a child that year who only attended school about 50% of the time, despite frequent calls to his house. I wanted to give all I had to each of these children to see them succeed, but I felt I was fighting a losing battle. And had I another year with this many students, I'm not sure I would have survived it. I was constantly staying late, coming home exhausted, and reporting to school early to try to get more done. Somehow we all made it, but I feel they could have been better served if I'd had a few less students. This is only the tip of the iceberg. You see, as teachers, we do so much more than teach. We provide social services, family services. We love the children, and we hurt with the children. We deeply care, but we can only give so much of ourselves as teachers. When we gather after school, we lament the children's needs and agree that these children deserve so much better. And I know that reducing class size costs money, but this is an investment in our human capital, in our society, and in becoming our best selves. Thank you for the opportunity to advocate for the class sizes that our students deserve.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. Tim Cowan.
Good Chair, Senator, and Task Force members. For the record, my name is Tim Cowan, and I'm going to do this really quick because I don't know how much parking I have left. The brochure that I gave you, I just wanted to use that so you can get interested in it enough to go look at the website. Roosevelt High School, my church, we went in and entered into a partnership with the high school, St. John's community, and the Portland School District. We had 1,500 volunteers the first day. We landscaped, we painted, we cleaned, we did anything to help the school. One of our members, after 6 years of being there, one of our members who is a designer for Nike, talked him into, and Nike came in and put in the second best sports facility in Portland. But they wanted to see if we'd stay. Then Neil Lomax was a church member, or is, and he coaches a football team. Well, the reason why I brought that up is we built a template, and now it's national, and a national nonprofit has taken it over for us. The last big project that I was aware of is in Detroit, Michigan. And not only did they work on the school, they started remodeling the houses around the school. Because once we remodeled a couple of the houses, then the ones across the street went, wait, how about me? Or the one next to it. So we kept going. And we think there was a total of about 15,000 that were involved over a period of time. So if you take a look at that, it would help you in your school or your school district. We have a template, and I'll make sure that someone gets a hold of you, or you can just do it over the website. We think that we put in about $3 million into the project. And the one thing that I noticed, which I think I would like to include in the testimony, it's amazing what teachers and administrators will do when they think somebody cares. Because really what happened was we went and showed that we cared, and they went for it. And I imagine with that kind of a school where they were kind of on the short list, that the teachers didn't really feel like anybody cared. Well, as the end result, they had the greatest improvement in graduation rates in the state in Roosevelt High School. Okay, here we go. I'll do this quick. On my sheet of paper, I'll just go through some of the notes and let you read the rest of them. My interest in education is I used to teach for a short period of time. Wife taught. My father was a superintendent, retired of Ashland School District. My uncle was the president of the National Association for the Elementary Principals. So I have it in my family. Well, the first thing is at the time of the paragraph up above, the big thing in education, when I met the president of Tokyo University, was Japan had this phenomenal educational program. It was a lot better than what America had, so I had to ask him. I said, how do you compare our different school programs, our educational programs? He said, well, in the United States, your K through 12 is socialization skills, and college are your technical skills. In our program, K through 12 is the technical type of skills, and then we try to build in socialization skills in college. And I said, well, okay, which one's the best? And he said, yours. Because it's too hard when I get into college to try to teach them the same level of socialization skills. In the second paragraph, I think, kind of defends it a little bit. When I was nominated, I guess, or promoted to senior vice president, regional manager, I had Mid-Willamette Valley, Central, and Eastern Oregon for First National Bank of Oregon. My boss, my new boss, told me about how I was chosen. That the executives put the name on the boardroom table of who they thought should get the senior vice president position. And then once that was done, any executive officer could go in and pull somebody off the table that they didn't like or didn't want in that position. I was the only one left on the table. And he said, you weren't anybody's first choice. You were the only one who was acceptable to everyone. So I learned socialization skills K through 12. So now, one of the things I wrote down that I want to make sure that I cover, I think you're doing an excellent job, Chair and staff, task force members. I've had a chance to watch two of the meetings over the video. I think it's great what you're doing. The second thing is, I don't think that we, you get enough credit for what you do, and it doesn't go public. Because when you throw in education, what people will do is they'll go, this is how much it costs per student, and this is how much it costs now, or this is how much more in taxes we're going to have to pay. We don't include in that all the other stuff you do for kids that are outside the parameters of A, B, C's, and D's. You just listening to some of the things that the teachers have said and what you've said, you go way beyond that, and that needs to be communicated so you get credit for it. Okay, just a couple things in general, and if you, I don't want to go over these with any detail. The first one I'll go over is what's the impact of turnover of older teachers? I guess there's a pretty good turnover of the older teachers, and why? Well, number one, it could be what I'm going to get into is teaching's high stress. I went from high stress to banking, which was nothing. All you had to do is tell people no. Part of the reason for that is all the things we've added to what they have to do other than instruction. They have to do a ton of stuff that I think has very limited value to the quality of education those students get. Now, this was kind of interesting. My son is a teacher, and he doesn't want me to tell you that, so I won't tell you his first name. He mentioned, well, class size, he didn't like it if it went beyond 27. He thought that was a little bit harder to control. He's a first grade teacher. However, the one thing he said was size of the room, that the smaller the size, the more difficult it was to control activities. So I think one of the things we have to look at with our older buildings is what do we do with just the physical size of the building? Let's see if I can. I think I'll stop at that. You can read the other pieces to it.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome, Chair.
Thank you for the handout as well.
I got to see if I cost me $35 to testify.
At this time, we're going to go to Sarah Coyle.
Hello. I've been typing as I've been sitting, so I need to finish a quick thought. It might not be profound to you guys, but it's in my brain. Give me a second.
And then right after Sarah, our last speaker will be Jim Mannenbach. Okay. Got at it. While Sarah's finishing her thought, I want to congratulate Katrina Lee and Jeff and Paula. Let's see, Brian. Did I get everybody who's been to all three meetings? I didn't get you, Jessica.
I missed the first one.
Okay. All right. Well, Jessica definitely was there. I saw her. Thank you. And Paula, we got you.
Okay.
Would it be fair? I'm sorry.
Anne, you've been on the line once or twice. Yep, you're on now. Okay. Well, I appreciate you being online, and Sarah's ready to go.
Ask really quickly. By the way, I'm Sarah Coyle. I've been teaching for 15 years. I teach social studies and visual arts at the middle school and secondary level. It's probably written somewhere, but may I see quickly? I didn't have anything in my hand that told me who everybody was.
Oh, there's 14. If you want, there's 14 on this committee, and we have four representatives and senators, four of us from the legislature. We have the board chair from Beaverton School District. We have the language arts teacher from David Douglas High School, superintendent from Cascade High School. We have a seventh grade computer and STEM teacher. We have an executive director of the Salem Kaiser Education Foundation, second grade teacher from Forest Grove. We have a teacher from the Centennial School District, kindergarten teacher, and also board of directors of OEA. We have Brian Reeder from OEA, or excuse me, from the Department of Ed.
Okay.
Department of Ed.
Thank you.
And then we have an Oregon PTA president, and we also have an OEA president.
And so that's kind of in flux, who comes in and out from meeting to meeting?
We have people who are on the phone sometimes, people who are in the room sometimes.
Thank you.
And like I said, we've had at least four members who have been, four or five that have been to every meeting.
Okay, great. When I started teaching school, 22 to 26 was the average class size at secondary, and we know now that that's kind of unheard of, and that's one reason we're here. I'm encouraged that with the advent of the ESSA, which is the Every Student Succeeds Act, in Oregon, we have the opportunity to decide for our state what the indicators of school success should be. And I'm really hoping that through the work of this task force, class size will become one of the primary indicators of whether or not a school is evaluated as a success for their students and the community. Something I haven't heard as much of yet in this particular meeting is not only the numbers about teacher to student, but the support services as it relates to class size. And just a couple of notes, as I've been sitting and listening to what's been said so far, a few concerns have popped up in my head. So it concerns me that in Oregon, our class sizes, which are some of the highest in the nation, have become a new normal. And if we don't spotlight this as a primary concern, as funds do return to districts, they will be used for other areas and not to reduce class size. And I think this new normal is unacceptable, and we cannot look at it that way. Which brings me to a little bit of concern about the superintendent who brought in the information from a single researcher who told apparently that there are 100 things more important than class size. That's very concerning to me to hear somebody bring that in. It's almost as if... we've decided that this is the new normal, and we'll find other ways to deal with it when we should just be addressing the issue of class size. Teachers will do what's necessary to make it work in their classes, because that's what we do. We want our kids to be successful, but we'll never take away the importance of class size. It concerns me that when I heard the numbers about blended classrooms, the lowest numbers mentioned were charter schools, which all too often don't include high-needs children with 504s, IEPs, or English language learners. So sometimes I wonder about the numbers and how they skew information that we're interpreting. And it did concern me that I hear that the QEM is updated regularly, but currently in our state, there's no recourse for following it. There's no impact on the realities of our classrooms. And Susan, I think you mentioned that as being something that we can work on. I think Oregon can do better. I think we can do better. My great concern today is I'm concerned that our crowded schools are pushing too many of our families into privatized online charters that then further reduce funds available to serve our public students. I am a public online teacher. I currently teach at Hillsborough Online Academy, which is a fully online, non-charter public school in Hillsborough School District. I also have the perspective for teaching as an independent contractor for ORVED, which is also a nonprofit virtual online charter school that's funded through the state. And I consider myself a teacher that specializes in high-need students. I am concerned that we're going to address classroom sizes by using online schools as a way to lessen the amount of students in seats, and I hope that this task force will be very careful about approaching it that way, because online schools are not a catch-all. They're not a way for a single teacher to service more students at a time. In fact, I would say that it's probably the opposite. And so I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my students, and then I'll be done, and thank you for your time. On one end of the spectrum, I have a few gifted students who are able to tap into upper-level courses and work at a faster pace than is offered at their neighborhood school. I also work with homeschool families who have very involved parents. I work with the typical average students who are busy pursuing sports, musical careers, or professional dance, traveling with parents for work. I have one student working to be on the Junior Olympic hockey team, another who's working to be on the Junior Olympic ski team, a student who crosses the country to record music, a student doing missionary work with his family in Africa. These are my easy students. They are at grade level academically. They're motivated. They have very involved parents. They are also my smallest group of students. My greatest number of students are those who are extremely challenged in some aspect of their life. Medically fragile students dealing with cancer, cystic fibrosis, lung transplants, a lot of high anxiety students who cannot function in a packed classroom of 35 to 45 students. Students who are being bullied, students being moved around in the foster care system, students whose families are uprooted for economic reasons, students who must work to support their families or themselves, students who must stay home to care for younger siblings or perhaps an elderly family member, students who are already parents themselves. In addition to these personal challenges to their education, about 20% of my students are on IEPs or 504s or a combination of both. And unfortunately, too many of the students do not have the family support they need on their end to make the most of education in general, much less the complicated world of the online service model. Parents are working multiple jobs, dealing with substance abuse, or simply absent. Too many parents think that once their kids are teens, they can fend for themselves. And often, parents don't feel equipped to help with academics, or for my particular field, they don't feel competent with the technology. I found that online students need personal connections and support from educators, perhaps even more so than students in traditional settings. At the Online Academy, our strategies for supporting our students always start with what we call creating deliberate connections. So in addition to academic communications in the courses, we support our students through email, text messaging, phone calls, and in person. At Hillsborough School District, we expect kids to come in for face-to-face assistance once a week. So we do regular phone calls, et cetera. So just putting that out there as general information, as you're talking about class size and ways the districts are addressing class size, online options are fantastic, but please don't see them as a way to spread education a bit more thin in terms of the funding. I really definitely see this as a funding issue. It would surprise me that anybody would argue that class size does not directly impact our students on all the different levels, from emotional to academic. And I would really hope that the task force brings forth some recommendations that this becomes one of the indicators for success in our state, because I believe it's that important. All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Yes, Jim.
Hello, my name is Jim Monenbach, and I was a teacher for 31 years at Eagle Point High School and 4 years as a school board member. So anyway, I came mainly, came a long ways, mainly to give both sides of the coin, because I've seen the experience from both sides. And after seeing the experience from both sides, I still believe class size is a major, major impact on teaching. And I watched your first two meetings online and was very impressed with all the input. So I'm going to kind of hit a few different areas, some from my experience, and then some other things as far as what I would like to see is maybe some accountability measures and that type of thing. Now, one of the first things I wanted to mention, though, was from the last task force meeting. I believe it was Mr. Reeder said, smaller class sizes do seem to benefit low-income students the most. I remember that statement. And so I started thinking to myself, how many districts have more than 50% free and reduced lunch in the state of Oregon? Probably quite a few. I would guess the majority. And which students struggle with attendance and graduation the most? The low-income students. So it's something where I think that alone shows the importance of class size, just for that group of people, or group of students. Now, speaking of the time piece, you know, for my 31 years of teaching, if I was to grade all 180 of my students' papers, that's some simple math there, that would be 3 hours of grading if I spent 1 minute on each paper. So just to give you kind of a easy math equation there of time, because I have had 180 students before. And then, of course, you add in there meeting with students, lesson planning, committees, leadership capacities, professional development, IEPs. I mean, the list goes on and on. And then, of course, people have to remember you do have your own family, too. So that time is important also. So it's obvious that class size impacts time. As far as teacher turnover, I know our district has had one of the highest teacher turnovers in the state. And research studies that I even presented as a school board member, there was one that came to the conclusion, and I'll find this for you, and I'll get this sent to you. I just didn't have time to get it. But 3 to 5 years is about what it takes to become a quality experienced teacher. So if teachers keep resigning or getting fired or whatever the reasons might be, just because of the stress, you're hurting the achievement levels of the students. So you want to try and keep the teachers there as long as you can, as long as they're doing their job. And that's one of the issues there, is because the way state laws have been rewritten, it's much easier to fire excellent quality teachers because of issues other than their performance as a teacher. I have seen this firsthand as a school board member, and I can tell you that it's not really a fair judgment that is used a lot of times with the teachers. And it's a very high-stress job, and especially if you're in a situation where they always feel like their job is on the line, that just adds to the stress. Okay, another thing I wanted to bring up is in my, I think it was during my first 10 years of teaching, we had a class size contract language. And when we had a clause that did not allow administration to give high school teachers more than 160 students without providing an adult aide or like a teacher assistant in the classroom. And that worked really well. And it really kept the administration in, you know, putting their priorities in the right place, making sure that those class sizes stayed about right. And what was nice is if I did go over that extra teacher aide was really good, especially with having, you know, to spend 3 hours, you know, just on one assignment in a day, you have that aid there to help you out with that. So anyway, that's something I think. I think I heard someone mention that in one of the earlier meetings about Washington has something like that too. I thought that's what I heard. Is that what I heard? I don't know.
Well, I don't remember that exact comment, but I know that there is a difference between Washington State and Oregon as far as permissive language now.
Oh, okay.
You know, in our state contracts.
Oh, okay. All right. But anyway, so administration worked very hard to make that work, so the district did not have to spend the extra money. And it also made it more feasible to hire another teacher rather than pay several adult teacher aides. So they started seeing the reasoning there. So I would like to see some possibility of a state law on maximum student loads, if that's possible. Another issue that a lot of people don't really see, and I know when you're looking at budgets, it's confusing to a lot of people, but when you look at the ending fund balance or the cash carryover every year of a district, I've seen districts with 4% cash carryover. I've seen districts with 14% cash carryover. And I guess what's most concerning to me is to see that some of these districts that have the money, if they're not paying to lower class sizes and they're still struggling with graduation rates and they're still having other issues there needs to be something that either the Oregon Department of Education or that the state legislature can do to deal with that. Because I was really happy to see that there is a law out there now that they're starting to look at how all the districts spend their money. Isn't that true? Didn't that pass?
It did pass.
I think
pass.
That went all the way through. Yeah.
It did pass.
So I think that's something that people need to take a really hard look at, because the priorities are oftentimes not in the right place with the district. Just because they have that extra money doesn't mean they're spending it in the right place. I mean, when you have a 14% carryover and you still have too big a class sizes, there's something wrong. I would like to at least see the state be able to come in, because I know I've heard legislators in the past say, well, that's all under local control. Well, that's true, but when it gets to a certain point to where it's impacting the students and their achievement levels and that type of thing, there's got to be a time when the state can step in and say, okay, you have all this money, let's make sure it's being spent in the correct places. You know, so anyway, that was one other thing I wanted to really bring up, because I've seen that and it's real easy to look up on the Oregon Department of Education website and see what these different districts have as their ending fund balance. Okay, and the last areas was with accountability. I don't remember who the lady was that mentioned the TEL survey, but I think this is very important teacher input. The key, though, is participation and getting enough people to do it. Because what I've noticed, because I've gone to the TEL survey website, and I've seen that there are some schools that didn't get enough people participating to get the results. Now, one of the reasons why that has happened is because some teachers fear retribution. They're afraid of. Well, hey, they might know what I wrote down, you know, what I put down. And I don't believe that's possible with this TEL survey, but I think that really needs to be stressed with the teachers when they take this, that how important it is that they take this. I was really amazed looking at some of the results of the TEL survey and what it tells versus, you know, administration might say things are going one way and teachers are saying it's going another way. Well, this survey really shows you what's going on in a district. And I think it's extremely important that this is used in all of your educational areas, because one of the things I notice is the climate of a district is huge. And this really shows the climate of a district. The last thing on accountability is at one time, the Oregon Department of Education used to visit every school in the state once every 6 years. And I know that was a long time ago when they did that, but I really like that aspect of being able to really go into a school and see that everything's being done correctly. Let's see. Again, the TEL survey is one of the best accountability tools I've seen in my years of education, and hopefully this becomes a major tool from now on. And last of all, I just wanted to thank the task force, because after watching the first two meetings, I think you guys have done an excellent job, and the input's been great. It's good to see getting the input from people that are actually there in the classroom dealing with this all the time. And I do know from many years of experience, both as a teacher and as a board member, class size makes a huge difference. And I hope we can get something done in a law of some kind. So thank you very much for your time.
Jim, I appreciate your comments. Did you say you were from Eagle Point?
Yes.
Eagle Point. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
And you know where Eagle Point is?
And was it Eagle Point High School?
That's where I taught.
Okay.
And you know where that's at?
I do.
Okay, good.
And Eagle Point, Oregon. not too far from Phoenix and Talent.
Very good. You really do know.
Right.
Down in our southern part of the state, a lot of times people get confused where Paces are.
I actually taught down there for a while.
Okay, very good.
All right. Thank you very much for everybody who came to testify today. I really appreciate the time and the energy that it took to take some time off from your family and from your summer vacation or summer work schedule and be here today. So thank you. I would like to ask if there's... okay, I want to do this correctly, Victoria. So I want to make sure I've got this right. So at this point, then, I'm going to close the public hearing. Okay, did that.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. And now we're going to talk about, we have been trying to make this easy for folks, you know, when we are meeting. And we're. I appreciate all three of you being online today. That was wonderful, and thank you. And we're going to continue to try and see how many people we can get into the room, because I think face-to-face is always nice if we can do it. We have a couple of Google Docs out there. We were only getting four or five on a couple of dates, so we're still continuing to try to make that work. We know that we have to have a report, and the report was supposed to be in by the 15th of September, which means we need a couple of meetings to actually talk about possible recommendations and then have enough people for a quorum so we can actually make a decision and actually have a committee report that's not just a few folks. So we want to try to work toward that. So my only advice to myself is that we're going to keep calling you, and we're going to keep having either Victoria or Richard keep putting out some date ideas until we can find something that seems to get most of us either in the room or on the line. So does that sound reasonable? Is that okay? And then it's not scheduled, so don't get too easy about it, because we're going to get something out to you hopefully tomorrow with a few more date ideas to see how we can do that. And then I would just ask if there's any housekeeping or anything for the good of the order. Thank you for sticking with us and for coming to the meeting today. So I'm going to adjourn the meeting and task force. Adjourn the meeting and task force. The meeting today, so I'm going to